Good morning. First case this morning is United States v. Hutchins, not for the first time. Is appellant prepared to argue?
Yes, sir.
The government?
Yes, sir.
Appellant may argue.
May it please the court. I am Lieutenant Colonel Babu Kaza, here along with Mr. Chris Operson and Captain Tom Frickton on behalf of the appellant, Sergeant Larry Hutchins. Chief Judge Stuckey, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Granted.
This case has a 12-year history involving two separate trials. As we consider the issues before the court today, it's helpful for orientation to assess the lower court's findings about those first two trials. The lower court found that for the first trial, the government prosecuted the appellant for an alleged unlawful killing in Iraq in 2006. The government alleged that appellant committed murder and related crimes under plans A, B, and C. Plan A, kill insurgent leader Saleh Gowad. Plan B, kill one of Gowad's brothers. And Plan C, kill any random military-age Iraqi male that could be found. Now, the defense of the first trial conceded Plan A, but disputed the existence of plans B and C. The lower court found that the members of the first trial, through their verdicts, rejected plans B and C and convicted appellant only under Plan A. Now, this court later reversed that.
Go ahead. Please finish that.
This court later reversed the findings from the first trial, and appellant was taken to a second trial. At the second trial, the government once again presented plans A, B, and C as fundamental to the conspiracy and prosecuted appellant. So the issue before this court is whether it was a violation of double jeopardy for the government to present plans B and C and their related acts and evidence as essential elements of charges at appellant's second trial.
Please continue.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, specifically, double jeopardy through the doctrine of issue preclusion. Now, issue preclusion applies when an essential element of a charge has previously been subject to an acquittal. Now, with that orientation, I'd like to address 4 points with the court today. First, the standard of review to review the lower court's factual findings. Second, the applicability of issue preclusion at a rehearing. Third, the essential elements of a conspiracy charge. And fourth, prejudice and remedy. So turning first to standard of review, the lower court, pursuant to Ash versus Swenson, engaged in an extensive factual analysis of the first record of trial. Upon conclusion of that analysis, the lower court determined as a factual matter that the members had acquitted Sergeant Hutchins of plans B and C, of planning to get any random military-age male, planning to get anyone other than Saleh Gowad.
Counsel, that's the point that I wanted to ask you about, which is, and I think it's very important because, as you point out in your reply brief, the government didn't certify an issue challenging that point. Looking at the CCA opinion, it said, again, we find no abuse of discretion in the military judge's failure to conclude that appellant was acquitted of conspiring to kill anyone but SG, but will include this among the acquitted acts of misconduct as we proceed through with the analysis on the ruling of admission of the evidence. Did they actually find that he was acquitted, or did they just say, well, the lower court didn't find that, and we don't think that's an abuse of discretion, but we will assume for the purpose of argument or purpose of analysis that he was acquitted?
So the lower court rejected issue preclusion by saying that agreement wasn't an essential element of a conspiracy charge, but they engaged in the factual analysis as part of their 404B analysis. So the issue before this court is that, although it wasn't under the rubric of issue preclusion per se, they still engaged in those factual findings in order to assess 404B, because the fact of an acquittal is an element of a 404B analysis. So regardless of their legal framework, the factual findings remain and are not appealed before this court.
Sorry to have the same sort of question. Where exactly in the CCA opinion do you find that they say that he was acquitted of plans B and C?
Yes, Your Honor. So, in a couple of places.
Because, I mean, to be honest, I have not been able to find a CMO, CMR from the first trial in the joint appendix or in the record. And so it's not clear to me what exactly he was, the exceptions and substitutions went to.
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought he was convicted of an unknown man.
He was convicted of an unknown Iraqi male because that was the only thing that was on the charge sheet.
So if he was convicted of an unknown Iraqi male, and then he was charged in the second trial with murder of an unknown Iraqi male. I'm a little confused about the facts.
Yes, Your Honor. So, unknown Iraqi male, meaning the identity of the person that was actually shot, there was no clear evidence of that. The issue preclusion of double jeopardy analysis comes up when you're assessing it through the lens of conspiracy and what the appellant's intent was and what the object of the conspiracy was. Now, whether that unknown Iraqi male who was ultimately killed was Saleh Gobad taken from his house, or was that unknown Iraqi male some random military-age Iraqi male from a separate house that the squad happened to get in accordance with a plan. That's where the distinction comes in. Regardless of whether they're both called unknown Iraqi male, the key operative fact is what the nature of the conspiracy agreement was. And the members rejected that the nature of the conspiracy agreement was to leave Saleh Gowad's house and go anywhere else and get any other person.
But counsel, the government says that it could have been the case that the members found that there was a conspiracy, the plan C, to kill some third person. They just weren't convinced that there was a conspiracy also to engage in housebreaking and kidnapping, especially given that the evidence was a little contrary on that.
Well, as an initial matter, the lower court's factual findings and analysis was that there was no inconsistency in that. And if I can quote from their opinion to address your point as well, Judge Ryan, the lower court noted the single rationally conceivable issue in dispute before the jury was whether the appellant had conspired to enter the home of Saleh Gowad and seize him, or to break into the home of someone else to kidnap someone other than Saleh Gowad.
That's true, but the CCA, the Court of Criminal Appeals, also said we're not finding an abuse of discretion by the trial court, by the court martial, by the military judge, I should say, in failing to conclude that he was acquitted.
Right. The factual findings remain nonetheless as part of the 404B analysis. And just to close that quote. And the jury, by its verdict, found that the appellant had not conspired to break into the home of anyone other than Saleh Gowad or kidnap anyone other than Saleh Gowad.
Well, that goes the scope of the conspiracy, I guess. But I'm as puzzled as my colleagues. We're not talking about housebreaking here. We're talking about killing A, B, or C. Does it really matter whether it embraced housebreaking?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So kidnapping and housebreaking. So getting back to Yes, Your Honor. So kidnapping and housebreaking required seizing somebody and entering into someone's house where you did not have the authority to enter into that house, and you did not have the authority to seize that person. So housebreaking and kidnapping, based on the only issues that were in dispute, there's no dispute as to what the squad actually did.
Wasn't charged with those offenses at the second trial. So whatever importance it had to the first trial in terms of him being convicted for it, he wasn't charged with it.
So the housebreaking, and kidnapping charges were dependent on the intended victim being anyone other than Saleh Gowad.
Why couldn't you housebreak and kidnap Saleh Gowad? However you pronounce it.
You could not, Your Honor.
Why?
Saleh Gowad was an authorized target as a high-value individual.
Oh, okay. Okay. It would have been protected conduct.
And as the lower court analyzed the record, that's what the lower court determined the members found. Because Saleh Gowad was the intended target, housebreaking and kidnapping were not crimes because the person that they planned to seize and take from his house was someone they were authorized to seize and take from his house.
Okay. Well, then back to Judge Ryan's question. It doesn't appear the second time around, so what difference does it make?
But your whole argument assumes that the only person that they could have convicted him of murdering in the first trial was the high value person, right? And I'm not following your argument, particularly since who the victim was didn't matter at all in the second trial. So it could have been anybody.
So at the second trial, what the government could not do was present the same conspiracy agreement that was rejected at the first trial. That conspiracy agreement that was rejected at the first trial was seizure of someone else, as evidenced through housebreaking and kidnapping.
And they didn't.
Correct. And they,
right, and the government didn't. The government didn't try to prove. So where are we?
So at the second trial, when the government presents plans B and C and says someone other than Sally Gowad was the intended target, that necessarily invokes housebreaking and kidnapping.
Well, no, not if he went with them voluntarily.
There's no evidence of that in the record, Your Honor, and the lower court's factual analysis found that there's no evidence of that.
Well, the government says, though, that the evidence was kind of mixed, that initially his hands were not cuffed, and initially he walked some distance with them, and then later he got the victim started dragging his feet and trying to turn around and was cuffed. And I mean, I think the government's position, and I'll let the government clarify, is that there might have been enough evidence to conclude that there was a conspiracy that would embrace killing a random third-party person, but there wasn't enough evidence to find the specific points that they were going to break into his home and kidnap him, especially because at the time they made the conspiracy, they didn't know who this random third-party person was.
So turning to the Ash versus Swenson analysis, the Supreme Court talks about using common sense, realism, and rationality and looking at the entire record. Now, certainly you could look at any record and say, well, they could have made their findings on X or Y, or they just was an act of lenity. What Ash versus Swenson asks courts to do is to actually look at the record and make that assessment. The lower court did that, made that assessment, and found to the extent that there was any sort of discrepancies, they were of no legal relevance or impact. And I would further point out that no party argued that. And further, the defense conceded that this person was seized and taken from his home. So there can be no dispute on a point that the defense has conceded at the first trial. So again, the lower court is correct in its analysis that the only rationally conceivable issue in dispute was the identity, not any of these other factual considerations.
Well, if the defense conceded it, then, wait a minute, was he convicted or wasn't he? Now I'm totally confused. Was he convicted at the first trial of housebreaking and he was acquitted?
He was acquitted.
Right, and then the government tossed those and didn't try him again, didn't try to push him again. Right.
Well, they did by saying at the second trial that the person that they got was somebody other than Sally Gowad. And by doing that, that's housebreaking and kidnapping.
Well, that's, I think.
Did they need to prove, to get conviction in the second trial, did they need to prove housebreaking and kidnapping?
So housebreaking and kidnapping certainly weren't on the charge sheet, but what was on the.
Then they did not need to prove them to get conviction. So at least as I read Courier, it's not an ultimate fact, and I don't understand your argument.
So the ultimate fact is for the conspiracy charge, Your Honor. What was the agreement? What was the scope of that agreement? What were the intended acts from that agreement? That was what needed to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Conspiracy agreement.
Which particular fact within the conspiracy group? What particular fact is it that you're saying he had to have been acquitted in the first trial and it had to have been proven in the second trial? Because you're talking about charges, you're not talking about facts.
Right, so the conspiracy agreement at the second trial that was charged, that was erroneous, was the government arguing to the members and presenting to the members that the agreement element of that conspiracy charge included getting somebody other than Sally Gowad, going to somebody else's house and taking him out. That was the error from the second trial, that including that in the agreement. That should not have been allowed by the military judge. Now, that same evidence was presented at the first trial, and the members excised out those acts of going to someone else's house. Yet those same acts were part of the agreement.
Counsel, let's be clear. The members excised out the conspiracy to go to somebody else's house and then also those acts of going to somebody else's house, which would have been overt acts in furtherance of that conspiracy. But isn't it possible that somebody could conspire to kill a third person without conspiring to kidnap them and to break into their house, especially when at the time they make the conspiracy, they don't know who that third person is?
I think that gets to a prejudice analysis to an extent. If you look at what the government presented at the second trial, they presented the same exact theory from the first trial and the same exact evidence and facts which were rejected. They said Sergeant Hutchins, in his mind, cold-blooded killer, he conspires, let's kill any random guy we can find. That's debunked at the first trial. Yet at the second trial, the linchpin of that conspiracy agreement, again, is Sergeant Hutchins saying, let's kill any guy that we can get.
It was only debunked. I mean, your theory, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but your theory is that they could not possibly have convicted him of conspiring to kill a random third party because they acquitted him of housebreaking and kidnapping that third party. But the government's position, I believe, is, well, they may have acquitted him on those aspects of the conspiracy, but not the random third party in general.
And again, going back to the lower court found, that is, in fact, what the members did. But it did, in fact,
and that's
it.
And that's why I'm so stuck on this very important point, which is that the lower court said, we find no abuse of discretion in the military judge's failure to conclude that the appellant was acquitted of conspiring to kill anyone but SG. It's an unusual statement with like it's got a double negative. I'm just trying to figure out what the CCA actually decided, because as you point out, the government didn't certify the issue. And so if that's what the lower court found, then maybe we're stuck with that. But what does that language mean? We don't find any abuse of discretion in the lower court's failure to find that he was acquitted.
They find no abuse of discretion in the military judge's putative application of MRE 404B. That's what they're talking about. His 404B analysis, or lack thereof, because he made no findings, was not an abuse of discretion. As part of them finding there was no abuse of discretion, they did, in fact, review the record of trial and make factual findings to determine if 404B was properly used in the circumstance. As part of that 404B analysis, they made a factual analysis of the acquittals at the first trial, noting that the fact of an acquittal is a relevant consideration for 404B analysis. So that factual finding was, in fact, made as part of the lower court's finding on 404B. And therefore, and is not appealed, and is therefore, in terms of facts, at least.
So your point is essentially that all they were saying was, even if he didn't find that they were acquitted, that wasn't an abuse of discretion.
Right. That's the lower court's determination, that based on the way they assess 404B, even though we find that there were these acquittals, we find under Ash versus Swenson, this is what happened. It was not an abuse of discretion because the conspiracy agreement was not an essential element of the conspiracy charge. Now, as we point out in our brief, conspiracy agreement is the essential element of the conspiracy charge. If the agreement included murder, obstruction of justice, housebreaking, kidnapping, that was a violation of double jeopardy. I see that I'm out of time, so if there are no further questions.
Chief Judge, I do have one question, and I hate to come in at the last minute here, but Colonel Kazaa, a number of the overt acts under the conspiracy specification include actions taken against the unknown Iraqi male. And so my question is, and I think the government raises it in its brief, if the overt acts are indeed actions taken by the accused in furtherance of the conspiracy, don't they necessarily embrace a conspiracy to kill the unknown Iraqi male? Do you know what I'm getting at here?
I do understand, Your Honor.
And so that would appear to be inconsistent with your view that the conspiracy to kill the Iraqi male was something he was acquitted of. It seems like the members found him, they didn't accept that language out in the first trial. All of those overt acts under the conspiracy to commit murder, a number of them contain actions taken against the unknown Iraqi male. They didn't accept those out. That would suggest that includes conspiracy to kill the unknown Iraqi male as well as any other conspiracy to kill anyone else, including the high-value target.
So the distinction there, Your Honor, is the term unknown Iraqi male. The government, I believe, argues that the term unknown Iraqi male inherently means random Iraqi male. To the extent the facts played out at the first trial and even at the second trial, the term unknown Iraqi male just referred to the body that was involved in these offenses. It isn't, in fact, a term of identification. But the terms of identification were found through which overt acts were accepted. So, yes, somebody was, in fact, killed, and they can't identify who that person was. That's the meaning of unknown Iraqi male, not that this is a random person that was found and they did some things to this random person.
Well, let me ask you this. I noticed on the original charge sheet that there was a name for this individual, but it was accepted out at the trial or before trial, I think on July 30th of 2007, before the trial. And so the name of this individual was accepted out and inserted without objection apparently from the defense at trial, to be an unknown Iraqi male. So I see what you're saying, that it doesn't go to identity, but I think as Judge Maggs raised earlier, the conspiracy, when it formed, if it did, could not have known who the individual was. If, in fact, it was to, if the plan or part of it was to kill this unknown person, if we couldn't get target A, then at that point, necessarily, they would not know who it is, would they? They couldn't know.
Right, under plan C, any person that it would have been, right, they would not have known the
identity. Right, but my point is, I guess my question is, it seems inconsistent with your view that your client was acquitted of the conspiracy against, to do anything to this unknown Iraqi male, if all of these overt acts were included and they all go to actions committed against this unknown Iraqi male and they are, in fact, in furtherance of the conspiracy, wouldn't they necessarily include a conspiracy to kill the unknown Iraqi male? That's my question again.
So, yes, there was a conspiracy to kill someone, absolutely. The findings was that the conspiracy was to kill Saleh Gowad, and the way that was...
Well, see, that goes back to my point that I think I'm raising. Your point is that he was acquitted of a conspiracy to kill an unknown Iraqi male, unless I'm wrong. Is that your...
Correct. That is correct, Your Honor.
And my question and my confusion is that it seems that if that's the case, why would the members include a conviction under the conspiracy count of overt acts that include a number of things they did to the Iraqi male, including unknown Iraqi male, including killing him, if in fact he was acquitted of, as you say, of a conspiracy to kill this unknown person?
Correct. So it's important.
I know it's convoluted.
No,
bear with me.
So it's important, I think, to take a step back and note what's before this court is the conspiracy charge and conspiracy agreement. Now,
I understand that. That's my focus as well. That's why I'm looking at these overt acts that were not accepted out in the first trial that include actions against the unknown Iraqi male.
So a person was killed that night, and his identity wasn't established. His specific identity of the dead body wasn't established at the first trial. What was at issue was not necessarily, per se, who that dead body was actually in that hole. What was at issue at the first trial was Sergeant Hutchins' intent and the intent in the conspiracy. And did his conspiracy include leaving Saleh Gowad's house and getting someone else? And that's the part that the acquittals were on, were leaving Saleh Gowad's house and what Sergeant Hutchins' intent was. Now, clearly the members grabbed an individual, and the members had no basis to accept and substitute in Saleh Gowad just because there wasn't any clarity there. But the more important aspect is, does that conspiracy include leaving Saleh Gowad's house and going somewhere else?
Right, but I guess from an evidentiary standpoint, how could the members conclude anything about the overt acts under the conspiracy count regarding an unknown Iraqi male if they don't know what the circumstances are? In other words, you can't just, I mean, you say he was acquitted of a conspiracy to kill an unknown Iraqi male, right?
And that's what the lower court said as well, but yes.
Yeah, then you, but my point is, I guess if I'm the members, I'm saying, how would the members be able to understand what happened leading up to the killing of the unknown Iraqi male? I guess this is my confusion here.
And I'm going to ask another related question, if you could just address, because I'm going to go back to where I started. If the charges on the charge sheet, as were presented to the members, and that he was found guilty of killing an unknown Iraqi male, and if he was charged with killing an unknown Iraqi male in the second trial, how can you argue that he was acquitted of murdering, of a conspiracy to murder an unknown Iraqi male? And you can address it on rebuttal.
Yeah, I would be satisfied with hearing that as well. And I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I'm trying to move things along.
Yeah. Can we? Can you address that on rebuttal, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So I think Judge Ryan's question is, the concern is similar to mine. So one response would suffice.
On rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Suki, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Kimberly Rios, and I, along with Colonel Mark Jamison, represent the United States. This court should find that issue preclusion is not implicated here for two main reasons. First, issue preclusion is not a vehicle to exclude evidence. And second, it is not implicated at a rehearing of prior vacated convictions. I'd like to first address why issue preclusion is not implicated to exclude evidence. As this court held in Hicks and the Supreme Court later affirmed in Dowling, collateral estoppel does not extend to preclude evidence that is otherwise admissible under 404B. It's important to note in this case that the rehearing consisted only of the vacated convictions and that the evidence that was introduced related only to the appellant's prior acquittals.
What it was he was acquitted of with respect to the conspiracy to commit murder in the first trial?
Your Honor, as the charge sheet would note, the appellant was convicted of conspiracy to commit murder, larceny, and obstruction of justice and false official statement. As you noted, the charge sheet does not list a victim. It does not list a conspiracy to murder someone specifically. And so we believe that the appellant was convicted of conspiracy to murder, including the overt acts that the members did not accept. The members also convicted the appellant of false official statements, and they acquitted him of housebreaking and kidnapping, assault, obstruction of justice. And we believe that that's this court's starting point.
Well, counsel, on what our starting point is, the CCA, the Court of Appeals, appears to have concluded that because he was acquitted of conspiracy to commit housebreaking and conspiracy to commit kidnapping, that Plan C must have been off the table, that he must have been acquitted of any theory which would involve killing an unknown random Iraqi male, because otherwise he wouldn't have been acquitted of the housebreaking and kidnapping charges. And that may or may not be correct, but I believe it's the appellant's position that that's what the Court of Appeals found, and the government didn't certify the issue, so we have to take that as a given. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. As this court held in Sheldon, this court can pierce through the CCA's determination when it's reviewing a military judge's decision on an evidentiary ruling. And second, in Zavala, this court stated that law of the case is not automatic, meaning that when the finding is clearly erroneous and a manifest injustice would result, law of the case would not apply. But we would agree with Your Honor's question to the appellant that finding is not really a finding. The CCA determined that the appellant was acquitted of that offense in their 404B analysis, an issue that the appellant now does not challenge, has not challenged that trial or at the CCA. So to the extent that it has any precedential value, we don't think it does. We don't think it's just dicta as it relates to, again, 404B. But we do think that it's also clearly erroneous, even if this court were to agree that it is a finding, because for the same reason that the appellant can't prove that he was acquitted of the issue of ultimate fact. We also think that the CCA...
Does he have to?
Yes.
Who's got the burden of what here?
Your Honor, the case law is quite clear that the appellant bears that burden. And I would like to note that it's not an insignificant
burden. Well,
normally
proving that one was acquitted isn't exactly difficult, but this whole thing seems as murky as a Paleozoic ocean. I don't know where we're. I honestly confess, I don't know where we are here.
Can you go ahead? That might potentially help. So let's assume that the CCA did in fact conclude that he was that he was acquitted of murdering SG in the first trial. Given that he was charged with conspiracy to murder an unknown man in the second trial, does it matter?
Well, Your Honor, a couple things. He wasn't charged at the first trial with conspiracy to murder an unknown Iraqi man. He was just charged with conspiracy to murder. But second, if this
I'm talking the predicate acts.
Yes, Your Honor. So even if this court were to believe the CCA's finding that he was acquitted of what the appellant is now alleging he was acquitted, then it would go to Judge Sparks' question that it would render the verdicts irreconcilably inconsistent. And that is, Bravo-Fernandez is actually where we would be at that point. And we believe that the appellant's argument and the CCA's proposed acquittal is irreconcilably inconsistent for two main reasons. The first, as, again, Judge Sparks noted, he was convicted of conspiring to murder, and the overt acts included an unknown Iraqi man. That's inconsistent with the appellant's argument that he was acquitted of conspiring to kill an unknown Iraqi man. Second, it's also inconsistent with the unpremeditated murder charge of which he was convicted. The unpremeditated murder charge...
Well, one can be convicted of murder without being convicted of conspiracy.
Yes, Your Honor, but here the members were actually given an instruction on both principal and co-conspirator liability. So if the members believe that the appellant was guilty of the unpremeditated murder charge of an unknown Iraqi man under co-conspirator liability, then that is inconsistent with the appellant's acquittal of conviction of acquittal of conspiring to kill an unknown Iraqi man.
Let me make sure you understand my question, and it might be a stupid question, but if he was, in fact, acquitted of murdering SG in the first trial, okay, let's say that somehow that's what they meant, even though it said unknown man, why would that matter for purposes of the second trial when, again, he was convicted of conspiracy to murder and the predicate acts all talk about an unknown Iraqi man and say nothing about SG?
Yes, Your Honor, so it wouldn't matter, particularly because the appellant here is asking to exclude evidence. He was not charged at the second trial with conspiracy to kill any specific person. So the appellant needs to be able to show that it was an issue of ultimate fact at both trials. And not only does he fail to show that it was an essential element, essentially, at the first trial, but he fails his burden even at the second trial. And that's really the only way that we get to an issue preclusion type analysis is when it's an issue of ultimate fact at both trials. But here, we don't really, it's confusing, Your Honor, because at the same time, we don't really need to get to an issue preclusion analysis. It's important to note that we are here because a judge denied the appellant's motion in limine to exclude evidence. And because of that, we really don't need to talk about Ash versus Swenson, Bravo Fernandez, or any of those cases, because his requested relief is to exclude evidence. It would be a different story if the challenge, of course, was to the charges, but that's not where we are. So to answer Chief Judge your question, that's where we are in this case. We're in a land of Dowling where the requested relief is to exclude
evidence. We're in the land of exclusion of evidence where the standard is abuse of discretion, and the government's position is that's all you need. Am I right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay, yeah, he didn't abuse his discretion. Case over, bye-bye.
Exactly. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And make no mistake, the appellant first cites to no case where issue preclusion is used to exclude evidence. And second, he's firmly asking this court to overturn its ruling in Hicks and Dowling and Felix, which affirmed Dowling and said that even though the evidence overlaps between two prosecutions, it is not the same thing as being charged with that evidence.
So I'm clear, counsel. Are you saying that Dowling stands alone, or do we have to first engage in an Ash analysis before we can get to Dowling?
Your Honor, when the requested relief is to exclude evidence, Dowling stands alone. There is no Ash versus Swenson type analysis that needs to be made because he's not being recharged at the rehearing with the same offenses that he was acquitted of.
Is it the government's position that an issue of ultimate fact is synonymous with the criminal justice term of element of an offense?
Yes, Your Honor. In many cases...
So then does it follow, would the government's argument be that we line up the elements of the offenses of which he was acquitted at the first court-martial, line up the offenses of which he was convicted at the second court-martial, and see whether there are any overlap of those elements, and that in this case, there is no overlap, and therefore, we've sufficiently addressed Ash, and we jumped to Dowling?
Yes, Your Honor. So, I would say 99% of the time, an issue of ultimate fact is going to be an essential element.
Devil is in the details then.
Right.
So when is that 1%? So it's not synonymous. There is a difference between issue of ultimate fact and an element of the offense.
There can be. So, for example, I'll use Ash. There, the court held that the issue of ultimate fact was Ash's identity. Now, if you line up the offenses of which he was charged, you're probably not going to find the appellant's identity. But of course, it's an issue of ultimate fact. You can't find him guilty of an offense unless you find that he actually did it.
You also can't put in evidence. So, for example, in this case, at least as I understand the case law, in this case, if he was acquitted of killing A.G. in the first trial, and finding that he killed A.G. was necessary for a conviction in the second trial, you could not put in evidence that he killed A.G.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right. Because at that point, you need to find... The key is it needs to be essential to the judgment.
Right, but all I'm saying is that I think that Judge Olson's point is you can't skip to it's only evidence until you rule out the fact that it's that sort of evidence. So you're wrong on that point.
Well, counsel, I'm surprised at your answer because it would seem under a 404B analysis that the mere fact that somebody is acquitted of a crime wouldn't preclude the use of evidence, the same evidence, because it's at a lower standard for 404B.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm sorry if I probably just didn't answer your question correctly, Your Honor, but so when at the rehearing it's not an issue of ultimate fact, which most of the time is going to be an essential element, when it's not an essential element at a rehearing and that evidence of that's related to that issue of ultimate fact, that essential element, is not being charged, then yes, that evidence can come in because it's under a lower standard of proof, and we're back at Dowling. Again, I think Felix is instructive on this point that it's a basic yet an important principle that even though the evidence overlaps, he's not being charged. So if it's not an issue of ultimate fact at the rehearing or at the second trial, then issue preclusion does not apply.
So what? Go ahead.
What, in your opinion, are the issues of ultimate fact at trial two?
I would start with the charge sheet, Your Honor. It was conspiracy to murder, larceny.
Concentrate on the dead guy. Go ahead.
Sure. So it was simply conspiracy to murder. And
conspiracy to murder somebody.
Yes, Your Honor. And... unpremeditated murder of an unknown Iraqi man.
Right. So there's conspiracy and then there's murder, two separate.
Yes, Your Honor. Charges. Yes. And as Judge Ryan...
And two separate articles.
Correct. Right. And as Judge Ryan, as you mentioned, it wasn't... The victim's identity was simply not an issue of ultimate fact for the first trial and at the rehearing. Under any scenario, issue preclusion cannot apply at a rehearing, either because the evidence relates to a prior acquittal, and Dowling tells us that issue preclusion doesn't apply, or even if this court were to believe the CCA's finding and to believe that the appellant was acquitted of conspiring to kill an unknown Iraqi man.
Okay. Ultimate fact does not include, in your opinion, housebreaking, the absence or presence of housebreaking, kidnapping, or the identity of the dead guy.
That's correct, Your Honor. Both at the rehearing. Yes.
At number two.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I just want to be clear with your argument. You're saying there's a distinction in the military system, because we're talking about a rehearing. And you're saying we really shouldn't be speaking of a first court-martial and a second court-martial. We really should be speaking of first court-martial and a rehearing, which is distinct from how it would be viewed in the civilian system.
Yes, Your Honor.
But is that is a distinction within the military system. But would that really address the constitutional concerns that have been expressed by the Supreme Court about at a subsequent proceeding that this information could come back in? So the question is, yes, that's a distinction, but is it a distinction with a constitutional difference?
No, Your Honor. First, because if the accused is challenging the evidence that's related to a prior acquittal at a rehearing, because it's a challenge to the evidence, issue preclusion is not implicated. If he's challenging the charges, and at the prior proceeding, the verdict was consistent, meaning the members decided on one set of issues of ultimate fact, acquitted, second set, convictions, then issue preclusion is not implicated at the rehearing because we're only talking about the vacated convictions. And then the third way is, even if those issues of ultimate fact overlapped at the first trial and some of them are at the rehearing, then we're in Bravo Fernandez and those verdicts are irreconcilably inconsistent. And that matters because the appellant bears the burden to show, I was acquitted of committing this issue of ultimate fact. And it's not an insignificant burden. As the court in Currier held, even if it's unlikely or very unlikely that the original jury acquitted without first finding that issue of ultimate fact in his favor, in order for issue preclusion to apply, this court must be able to say that it was irrational, that the members acted irrationally. If they acquitted without first finding in the defendant's favor that essential conviction in the second trial. So it's not an insignificant burden. He has to show that it was the single rationally conceivable issue at dispute in the first trial, and that he was acquitted of that. And he bears that burden. And the fact that this court is confused, or Judge Maggs, as you posited, well, the members could have believed that Sergeant Hutchins conspired to murder, but he just didn't conspire to housebreak and kidnap. That shows that he has failed his burden to show that he was acquitted of that issue of ultimate fact.
I just want to make sure I understand the first prong of your argument that you just made there. I just want to make sure I understand the full contours of it. Are you saying that under Dowling, that if evidence is coming in under 404, that we do not have to be concerned about Ash, that we are simply saying it's coming in as 404, it is not coming in to prove an offense specifically, that we are simply looking at Dowling. We don't have to be concerned about Ash at all.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is straight from Dowling and Felix, because they held that the Constitution is not the protection there. The protection is the rules of evidence. What governs are the rules of evidence. When it relates to the admissibility of evidence, even though it relates to a prior acquittal.
So your point would be that this is actually a fairly straightforward case where we don't have to get into much of what has been discussed here. We can focus on strictly on Dowling, saying this evidence came in as 404 evidence, and that was not problematic here, as the Chief Judge was talking about earlier, we're simply looking at an abuse of discretion by the military judge. So you're saying it is that narrow of an issue that's before this court?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, your time is up, but since counsel for the appellant had substantial additional time, if there's further points you'd like to make, please do.
Unless this court has any further questions, then this court should find that issue preclusion is not implicated here and affirm the findings in the sentence below. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal? And would you please address the questions from Judge Ryan and Judge Sparks in the course of your rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. So addressing those questions first, I believe the first distinction to be made is the term unknown Iraqi male. It's a descriptor term. It's not a term of legal art or legal relevance in terms of the charge. What we're talking about is the conspiracy agreement, and did the conspiracy agreement include kidnapping and housebreaking? The phrase unknown Iraqi male doesn't implicate that part of the analysis in terms of what was in Sergeant Hutchins' mind when an intent and agreement with the other actors. So whether it was Sally Gowat's house or another person's house, either way, it can still be described as unknown Iraqi male. That has no legal weight. So I think what's important is that the government talks about evidence. We are, in fact, talking about charges, talking about the conspiracy charge. And the way the evidence plays into that is that conspiracy charge at the second trial is impermissible if it's the same conspiracy charge from the first trial that he was acquitted of. And the determination of whether or not it's the same offense, and leave to turn to Currier, which, again, is only plurality opinion and attempts to walk back Ash versus Swenson, but even taking Currier as law, it talks about a standard of functionally the same offense, that's what Ash was talking about. Is it functionally the same offense? So here, was the conspiracy charge at the second trial functionally the same as the conspiracy charge at the first trial? And it absolutely was, because the conspiracy charge as presented to the members was that Sergeant Hutchins' plan included going to someone else's house and getting someone else other than Sally Gowat. So in that aspect, issue preclusion was violated, and certainly the constitutional consideration trumps 404B, and it needs to be primary.
Counsel, can you specifically respond to the government's argument that there's no question about issue preclusion here? The only question is about whether this evidence could be admitted, and that if all you're talking about is admission of evidence on a rehearing, issue preclusion doesn't come up.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So, again, we're talking about the charge, the conspiracy charge, and the co-conspirator liability under the other charges, and whether those double jeopardy is violated through the presentation of this evidence in theory. The government's reliance on 404B cannot trump the constitutional analysis. Regardless of whether this could be admitted under 404B, if this was a violation of double jeopardy and Sergeant Hutchins was facing functionally the same offenses at the second trial as he was acquitted of at the first trial, then that violation trumps any sort of 404B. And the distinction on how we assess whether this is issue preclusion or 404B is whether there's an issue of ultimate fact. And here the issue of ultimate fact the appellant would implore this court to look at is the agreement fact, the agreement element of the conspiracy charge. What was that agreement? If the agreement included housebreaking and kidnapping in the second trial, then that agreement was an invalid basis for that charge, and that co-conspirator liability was invalid for the murder and larceny charges.
Your argument that you're making is that this is a violation of double jeopardy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That somehow there's a violation of double jeopardy. Is that your argument?
Right, through issue preclusion. Now, we mentioned in our reply brief, I think you can also apply claim preclusion as well. It's not necessary in this case, but claim preclusion applies to the extent that the conspiracy charge is functionally the same, where you could perhaps consider it a prosecution of a greater offense after conviction for a lesser-included offense. Certainly not the primary thrust of our argument, but certainly available to this court if it were to choose to apply claim preclusion instead of issue preclusion. If there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
I actually have one. I know you have 45 minutes left.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you your money's worth. This may not have a whole lot to do with much, but I noticed in the charge sheet, in the findings on the first trial, the accused was acquitted of the assault that alleges that the unknown Iraqi man was unlawfully forced to the ground and his hands and feet were bound. And but I also noticed that that same conduct is pleaded as an overt act under the conspiracy to commit murder. What are we to make of that? I mean, that sounds like it's inconsistent. You would think that if the members acquitted the accused of this assault in this fashion, that they would also accept that particular overt act out of the conspiracy specification. Wouldn't it make sense to do that?
Certainly on its face, I can see that point.
Well, how do we explain that, then? Other than to say it's simply an inconsistency.
Right, so the fundamental issue, again, it ties into the housebreaking and kidnapping. The issue is the squad had lawful authority to seize and detain Saleh Gowai. The mm-hmm. assault is an unlawful touching. It was an unlawful touching to push that Iraqi to the ground and bind him if there is no lawful authority. Because the members found that the object of the conspiracy was Saleh Gowai, there was lawful authority to enter his house, lawful authority to bind him, and lawful authority to force him to the ground. And that is the explanation for the members' findings. Again, that's also the only issue that was in dispute at the first trial. The defense didn't challenge that this guy was pushed to the ground or zip-tied or taken against his will somewhere. The defense's only contention was that Sergeant Hutchins' conspiracy was that this guy was Saleh Gowad, and they had the lawful authority to do that. So to the extent that those crimes of an unlawful touching or entering somebody's house without permission or taking them without permission were crimes, those were not part of the conspiracy and not part of the criminal agreement. Yet that was the heart of the government's case at the second trial.
Well, I could be wrong in this, too, but and then I'll be finished, Chief Judge. But I could be wrong on this, too, but isn't an overt act part of the conspiracy? The language in the law is that these acts are committed in furtherance of the conspiracy. So isn't it necessary for us to conclude that a conspiracy embraces these particular acts? In other words, a conspiracy to commit murder would include any acts committed. I guess I'm still...
So the acts were in fact committed in furtherance of the conspiracy, but those acts were not a separate criminal charge of assault because they were not unlawful touchings. So yes, the acts occurred, the members found the acts occurred, they were in furtherance of the conspiracy, but they were not the crime of assault because the intended victim was Saleh Gowad, someone who they had lawful authority to lay hands on.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess until 10:35.
Court standing.